This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, police in Buffalo, New York, are up to the same tricks as were exposed in Ferguson, Missouri, saturating the Black community with police checkpoints to fatten the city treasury. New York City cops use a secret list of 42,000 alleged gang members to justify mass arrests in Black neighborhoods. And most people on the planet think it's a good idea for the U.S. and Russian presidents to have a summit meeting, except for the Democrats and U.S. corporate media.
But first, cities across the country are going deeply in debt, selling bonds to speculators to pay for judgments and settlements against cops that brutalize their citizens. The Action Center on Race and the Economy did case studies in Chicago, Los Angeles, Milwaukee, Cleveland, and Lake County, Indiana, showing that these so-called brutality bonds are costing the localities almost $2 billion. Angela Peoples is director of the Action Center's campaign. She's also with the Washington, D.C. chapter of Black Youth Project 100.
Police brutality bonds are essentially bonds or loans that a city may take out to cover the cost of settlements that are issued as a response to incidents of police violence, whether that's rape, sexual assault, the murder of young Black folks. What our research has found and what this new report outlines is just how costly these police brutality bonds are and how expensive lack of accountability is for police violence and misconduct. Because there's no other way for accountability, often families seek some sort of financial retribution through the city or through the police department. And cities are taking out millions and millions of dollars. And these bonds are issued and the profits generally go to large banks, things like Wells Fargo or JP Morgan and Chase, some that are featured in our report as both issuing these reports and then profiting off of the fees and the interest from paying that back.
Yes, and we're talking about a great deal of money. That study that you guys did was of Chicago, Los Angeles, Milwaukee, Cleveland, and Lake County, Indiana. And it appears that those cities have racked up $1.7 billion, not million, billion dollars in debt because of the actions of their police.
That's correct. In fact, in Chicago alone, over the next 12 and a half years, Chicago will pay $198 million in interest alone on bonds and settlements. That isn't just for police bonds, that includes some other things, but that's just the interest on those payments. So there are millions and millions more dollars across the city, across these cities.
You would think with that kind of financial burden that even without community protest, that cities would have an incentive to rein in these police depredations.
That's right. One of the things that we saw is that, and one of the big problems that we highlight in our report is just the extreme lack of transparency with these bonds. And some cities don't even really calculate their bond spending, whether that's on bonds that pay for settlements or from police violence or settlements from healthcare lawsuits. So there's a lot of questions that we have and that I think that communities should be asking their elected officials as to why aren't cities tracking this data? Why aren't they being accountable to the amount of spending that's going towards police violence? And this is, again, in cities where police budgets are already swollen, right, are already more significant than, say, education or mental health services. We think that there's a real crisis here that cities should be accountable to where they're spending. We don't know if perhaps some of the spending was paid for settlements that were even for the same officer, you know, sort of repeat offenders, if you will. None of that information is tracked. So that's one of the things that we call on cities to do to fix this issue, to have more transparency and to be more accountable with where the spending is.
And since these banks have such influence in the cities where they're located and in the country at large, they certainly don't have a problem with cities going in debt to pay for brutal police.
Certainly not. One of the things that we suggest in our report is that we think that is completely appropriate and often necessary for families that have been victimized by police violence to seek some sort of retribution, some sort of payment, some sort of adjustment to the grievances that they have. We actually think that's necessary. But what we don't think is that banks that are already harming our communities in so many ways, whether that's foreclosures, whether that's financing the growth of private prisons and detention centers, we don't think that those banks should be profiting off of that. And so we call on financial institutions to stop charging the fees and the fines onto these different bonds, because that's really where a lot of the cost comes from, or is accumulated.
And one of your recommendations is that the cops be forced to cover themselves with insurance and not put the burden on the public.
That's right. We think that there is a need for individual officers to be held accountable in more ways than one. And insurance is just one small step that could be done. I mean, hopefully the insurance is not just a way for families to seek some sort of accountability, but it's also a deterrent for police officers to commit these egregious crimes.
Well, of course, if there is no punishment for officers who are brutal towards citizens, then the cost of insurance would be just part of the cost of being a cop, just like the cost of having a police force full of brutal officers appears to be just accepted as part of the cost of doing business by the city.
That's right. And also seems that cities are taking on these debts without any awareness of the overall cost and also not factoring in that cost of these bonds into their police budgets. We think that if cities were being transparent and accountable to say just how much spending they were doing on these police brutality bonds and adding them into the police budgets, that we would see those budgets swell. And that's an important piece for folks to really know and to be educated about.
And you're also calling for full transparency in terms of who these cops are, the ones that commit multiple brutalities resulting in suits.
Absolutely. It should definitely not be the case that the cities are going into debt over and over again because of the vicious and the dangerous actions of one officer that is a repeat offender who has no accountability, it continues to be on the job, and then continues to cost the city so much in pain and suffering, but also in these bombs.
Now, you're the campaign director for this project for the Action Center on Race and the Economy, but you're also with the D.C. chapter of Black Youth Project 100. And Black Youth Project 100 advocates defunding of the police.
Absolutely. We advocate for defunding, and we advocate for a world without policing. And of course, as a member of BYP 100 in the DC chapter, I'm active in some of the issues that we're facing here in the nation's capital, which are relevant and connected to the issues that are facing in Chicago, in Cleveland, in Lake County, in Milwaukee, in Los Angeles, and places around the country. Our police forces are out of control. You can include in that ICE, the Immigration Customs and Enforcement, which is its own police force in and of itself. They're out of control, they're dangerous, and they're not keeping us safe. There's no safety with police. And so we're absolutely calling for the defunding of police in Chicago and D.C. and around the country.
That was Angela Peoples of the Action Center on Race and the Economy speaking from Washington.
Civil rights groups have filed suit against the city of Buffalo, New York, charging that for more than 5 years, Buffalo cops have been saturating black neighborhoods with police checkpoints for the purpose of extracting millions in fines. According to the suit, 91% of the checkpoints operating in Buffalo are located on the black side of town. We spoke with Keisha Williams, a staff attorney with the Western New York Law Center. She says what's going on in Buffalo is very much like the systematic draining of the black community through over-policing and excessive fines that a U.S. Justice Department report documented in Ferguson, Missouri.
Yeah, it is pretty similar. It's unfortunate that the city decided to sort of raid or use these communities to increase their revenues when it is obvious to everyone that these communities are already struggling and they just don't have it. They can't afford it. So it is pretty sad, I think.
The way you describe the police campaign and their deployment, it seems like a blatant revenue gathering operation. And you say that 91.4% of the checkpoints that they establish are in black communities or non-white communities.
Yeah. The stated objective for the checkpoint, the reason given by the Buffalo Police Department and the mayor and the former police commissioner, was that they were going to use these checkpoints to fight crime, to discover evidence of criminal activity. I think that the fact that these checkpoints also created a significant amount of revenue for the city, I'm pretty sure that didn't hurt. But the stated reason was to deter crime, and they budgeted the revenue into their annual budget. So it definitely was a revenue stream, created a revenue stream for the city.
So if they budgeted these stops, which have increased tremendously the revenue that the police have extracted from the community, they apparently plan to keep them up and have become dependent on them.
Absolutely. You know, it creates a conflict of interest, because the police, they are supposed to appear and be disinterested, and they are to serve in the interest of justice. They're not really supposed to be trying to raise revenue. That should not be their priority. It definitely creates an institutional incentive to continue to ticket and to do these pretextual traffic stops. And so the conflict of interest is a problem.
And this is not just a nuisance matter. These are mostly poor communities that are being preyed upon by these checkpoints.
Yeah, absolutely. These checkpoints could potentially lead to numerous tickets for a plethora of things. They are definitely targeted to the poorest neighborhoods, the neighborhoods that are already struggling financially, the neighborhoods that don't have enough access to health care and safe schools and all the things that the city should be providing for these neighborhoods, because they are the most needy, that they have decided that they're going to punish them for being poor, basically.
Yes, many people would say that having unaccountable police is a burden on the community, a burden on their rights. But in this case, it's also a financial burden.
Yeah, it is a financial burden, and it chills the folks that live in this community. They obviously, they have to deal with having their freedom to move about freely be restricted. They have repercussion of having daily interactions with the police. That does not end well for people of color. And I don't think it would end well for any community if you had pretty much a police state and you had barricades that you have to pass through on a daily basis to get to and from the places that you need to go.
Yes, it's difficult to imagine that this has not resulted in increased tensions between the community and the police, this constant predatory presence.
Yeah, and one wonders whether or not the people in the city of Buffalo, a city that has historically been known as one of the most racist cities in the country, you wonder if folks have just come used to the police presence and they have been living within the system, even though they have been complaining, but maybe they've gotten used to living under these circumstances.
Now, again, almost 92% of the checkpoints are in communities of color. What is the racial makeup of Buffalo?
I think 38% of the population is black. But it's pretty obvious the clear disparity that results from these unconstitutional checkpoints and traffic stops. Because what happens is you find that black and brown folks are disproportionately represented in the people who are arrested and the people who are ticketed and the people who lose their license.
And what position have the black representatives on the Buffalo City Council taken on these practices?
I think that over the years, there have been folks who have questioned the practice, but they have ultimately been satisfied by the explanation that this increased police presence, yes, some people are put out of the way, some people are inconvenienced, but we'll trade some of our freedom for the crime prevention or for the increased police presence. But the studies have shown that these police officers are not actually solving crime or they're not preventing crime. What they're doing is just setting up roadblocks and ticketing people for minor traffic offenses. So I don't think anyone ends up being safer or feeling safer. I think quite the opposite.
And as a consequence, you've filed suit. The plaintiff in the suit is called Black Love Resists in the Rust. Tell us about the suit and the plaintiffs who brought it.
The plaintiffs, we have, as you mentioned, the Black Love Resists in the Rust Belt. That is an organizational plaintiff. We have Dejan Hall, Dorothea Franklin, Taniqua Simmons, and Jane Doe. These are all members of the community of who have experienced checkpoints and who were willing to make the sacrifice of being plaintiffs in order to bring about change in their community.
And Black Lives Matter in Buffalo is also part of Black Love Resists in the Rust Belt. Have they been undertaking direct actions?
Yes, for years we've had these community activist groups who have been on the forefront of this issue, and they have been trying to have conversations with politicians and the mayor's office and the police, trying to get an ear, someone who's willing, someone who wants to have a conversation. And when the possibility of this lawsuit came about, they definitely have been working with the legal folks to get this done.
Well, you filed suit, and that sometimes is a long-term process, but what's going on day-to-day regarding this police checkpoint presence?
We filed the lawsuit today, and we hope that with the lawsuit, yes, as you mentioned, it's not a short fix or it's not an easy fix, but we expect that at the end of this process, at the minimum, we will have some protections, some measures implemented to ensure that the Buffalo Police Department trains and supervises and implements certain policies to prevent this from happening later on.
What specifically is the suit demanding?
We want the court to declare that the actions of the defendants through the checkpoints and these pretextual traffic stops violated the 4th and 14th Amendments. We would like the court to preliminarily and permanently enjoin the defendants from conducting the checkpoints in an illegal and discriminatory fashion. We would like for the court to enjoin the defendants from conducting traffic stops in a manner that targets on the basis of race and ethnicity, and also enjoin them from conducting traffic stops for pecuniary purposes. We would also like for the city to implement measures to ensure that the city documents all traffic stops and that they retain information in a computerized database so that there is some accountability, so that people can have information about the stops and make sure that they are following the laws, they're abiding by the constitutional restraints. We would like for the people who have been damaged by these practices to be awarded for the harm that's been done. The bottom line is that these checkpoints and traffic stops are unconstitutional and racially discriminatory, and they violate the Constitution. This should be an issue of concern, not just for folks that live on the east side, but this should be a concern for anyone who lives in the city of Buffalo. Because if cops are spending, if police officers are spending all their time and being focused on traffic stops and ticketing people who can't afford it, and eventually these folks have their license suspended, it prevents us from growing. It prevents those folks from being able to hold on to jobs, from being able to get from point A to point B to pick up their children. It harms the entire city. And this should be an issue of concern, not just for, like I said, not just for the people on the east side, but for everyone in the city, if we're going to move forward from what has become one of the main things that the city of Buffalo has been known for, the racism that exists here. And there is so much more. There are folks here who are progressive and would like for this to change and for everyone in Buffalo to have the equal protection of the law and for everyone to be treated fairly by the police. And hopefully we can get closer to that with the resolution of this case.
That was Keisha Williams in Buffalo, New York.
Black and brown activists in New York City are outraged that the police department maintains a database of more than 42,000 names of alleged gang members. The cops have used the list to bring conspiracy charges against hundreds of young people caught up in massive sweeps of poor neighborhoods. Shannon Jones is co-founder of the community organization Why Accountability. Her statement was read into the record at recent hearings of the City Council on Policing in New York. Shannon was interviewed by Black Agenda Radio producer Kyle Frazier.
We felt it was important for grassroots organization to be on the record, even though we were not there physically, because for one, grassroots need to make sure that we are on the forefront and upfront of all of these issues that plague Black and brown communities, because we are doing the most work. And when I say work, that includes understanding the issues, comprehending them, framing them properly, contextualizing them for our community, as well as the outreach and the labor around the work. So I knew from past city council hearings that even though folks that are quote unquote liberal or progressive, or even in some instances assist Black and brown people in advocating for them in the legal process, which may be legal aid attorneys, public defenders, 18Bs, other social service nonprofits, there is still a hierarchy in voice that plays out in these environments. So if anyone has the opportunity to watch the council hearing in its entirety on council.nyc.gov on June 13th, you will see that those nonprofit voices still held priority in speech at the hearing after the NYPD testified. So our letter was critical, vital, and necessary, and what it essentially did was indict NYPD for being its own gang, for which we've done before. So we were transparent and named names. So we include killer cops, Richard Hayes, Peter Liang, Daniel Pantaleo, etc., police officers that take bribes, sell guns, sell drugs, fix tickets, that run the gamut, insurance scams, sexual abuse, the police officers that are alleged to have raped Anna Chambers behind the Chipotle in Coney Island. We also made an indictment of the city council because we are aware to a degree that the hearing in of itself is a dog and pony show. These are the same elected officials that continue to fund the NYPD at unprecedented levels, which result in the racialized policing that we see in Black and brown communities, this type of uber operational terrorism from constant police presence, constant escalating interactions with the community, the floodlights and NYCHA projects, etc., which, you know, Why Accountability has fought against consistently over the last 4 years. So we named cops specifically, we held the city council into account, and we continue to assert that the NYPD is a gang, the biggest gang in New York, 37,000 strong in the city of New York. So it was important for that letter to be presented and openly read, and we do thank Brother Tariq, a.k.a. James Haskins, for delivering that message on the open record for us.
No doubt, and perhaps the largest gang in these United States. One question that arose during those hearings was that of the racial makeup of the so-called gang database held by the NYPD. One thing that the new chief of detectives, Dermot Shea, claimed was that the racial makeup was approximately 95% people of color. This number having been corrected later in the hearing to 99, given the fact that the numbers that he provided, 65% African-American, 24% white Hispanic, and 10% black Hispanic, adds up to 99%. I'm wondering what your thoughts were on hearing about the racial composition of the so-called gang database.
I mean, it matches up with all the other racialized imbalance in the city of New York when it comes to policing in the city, whether it be marijuana arrests, fair beating, all the way down to petty noise complaints, etc. So it certainly fit. I don't believe it was a shock to any black or brown person in the room. What was laughable was the NYPD's attempt to not make it look like a Negro database by asserting some white Hispanic designation, which the city council was bereft in even inquiring about what that means. I mean, that was one thing about the hearing that struck me, although why accountability was not in physical attendance. We definitely watched the hearing live from beginning to end. And there was no inquiry from the council about the race definition. So that was problematic in of itself. We in our conversation right now are saying black and brown, but what exactly is white Hispanic? And I dare not even venture a guess at that. That was for the police department to define, and it was for the city council to inquire and for the community to inquire. What we observed was this. The New York City Police Department had an unfettered 2 hours of talk time immediately following police testimony. All of the mainstream mass mind control media outlets got up and left. We must make a note of that. And nor was the community allowed to subject the police department to inquiry. So this is why we call it a dog and pony show. So we know it's 99%. The police department is not busting into Russian territory or anyone that could be considered Anglo-Saxon or even a white ethnic for that matter. So it follows with what we know and what we experience.
Absolutely. And similarly, another discrepancy as regards these hearings was the question of the numbers. How many individuals are on the database? What are their ages? All sorts of discrepancies as far as how those numbers are reduced and what the frequency of those reductions are. But when it all comes down to it, no one else is afforded access to this so-called gang database. So what was your take on the question of the numbers, the data that was provided by the NYPD and disputed during the city council hearing?
What it means for us, again, is something that we already know. Elected officials, including the mayor of the city of New York, basically allow the NYPD to do whatever they want to do. The hearing itself was so far out of balance that the appropriate questions were not asked to the NYPD from the city council. Because we're saying gang database because we don't know what it is. We don't know how many of them there are. We don't know how you get in, how you get out, where it's recorded. But what we do know is we have to foil to get skeleton information, but the information is readily shared on an intra-agency basis. So you may not know if you're in it, but the district attorney's office knows that you're in it. You may not know you're in it, but the NYPD may tell your child's teacher that you're in it. So there is definitely an intra-agency sharing of that information that continues to negatively impact black and brown stability in this city. So teachers are telling the police you're in a gang. The police are telling the DA that you're in a gang. Then you wonder why your bail is set at $30,000 for fair beating and you're sitting in Rikers. Okay? So the information is definitely shared, but not to the people that are impacted, which are Black and brown people, Black and brown families, Black and brown residents. So that is certainly problematic. So the numbers that were provided from NYPD's own information in response to the FOIL were in a fixed point in time. Hey, I got a hearing coming up. Let's run through this thing and let's purge 26,000 names so we don't look like we're collecting information on upwards of 50,000 Black and brown men under the age of 30 in this city. So it was a dog and pony show to attempt to have the NYPD look less like the KKK.
What we see now in recent weeks, directly after this hearing, is an outpouring of expressions of deep concern about the state of the city, the Bronx in particular, a very pointed attention and targeting of street families, specifically the Trinitarios who are being implicated in the June 20th murder of one Lisandro Guzman Feliz, allegedly killed by several individuals affiliated with the aforementioned street family, and the sensationalism has just been dense as regards this story. How do you feel that this connects with the kind of rhetoric that you have pointed toward as regards the city council hearing and how the NYPD has portrayed their presence in communities that they claim are gang territory?
Well, that situation is very, very loaded and complicated. And what I would say to the listeners on this broadcast is this. This is the reason why Black and brown people must become politically educated, must have an ideological foundation, must be clear about who our enemies are as we exist on this earth. Because after the hearing on 613, now it is necessary for the mass mind control media to report on street family violence in Black and brown communities. What that does is have the masses then turn back to the state for relief. So now there are calls for more police, even with the Justice for Junior hashtag, which in itself is a co-optation of Black liberation movements, which is really not even the subject of this conversation, so I won't even get into that. But we must keep our eyes opened on how, on a national level, all of the grassroots work that has been done by Black people to protest operational terrorism and the escalation of state violence against Africans and other brown people in this country has become a blueprint or template for other issues. And people have co-opted that and made it a template for their own individual causes, whether rightfully in some instances and wrongfully in many instances. I even see this Justice for Junior campaign being parallel to Emmett Till, which is not even a stretch. It's disrespectful in many ways. But to get to your question, I needed to say that in the background, we don't control the way mass media outlets report on information. Some people in our communities believe that there were other things that should have been reported on that level. So once it became known that this young gentleman was part of the Explorers program, which is indoctrination by the NYPD on Black and brown communities, and I strongly discourage any parent from enrolling their child in such a program. But this child was in the program, and once that was discovered, then it became a cop funeral, which was disgusting. And when we don't have political education, or we don't have an ideological foundation, we're not aware on how the state continues to exploit us.
I'm wondering if you happen to see the photos and or video, which seems to have now been suppressed, of the two NYPD officials standing idly by during those last moments of this young brother, Lisandro Guzman Feliz's life. And if so, your thoughts on that particular underreported aspect of this story.
Exactly. So I saw those videos, and this is what it is. The NYPD viewed that young man as a gang mongrel until they knew that they were able to exploit him. The first 4 hours, mass mind control media communicated it as gang related. Once NYPD figured out he was an explorer, then he was part of the Big Blue Gang. He could be represented as a good kid. He could be represented to push respectability politics to black and brown people, which many, many of us fall for. So those two cops stood right there and didn't give a damn that that young man was bleeding to death. Didn't give a damn. The New York City Police Department is us versus them. Period. Period. And it was only until he could be exploited was when they gave a damn. I don't know who's in the ear of these family members. And this is a problem across the board when it comes to the state, when it comes to white supremacy and white nationalism. The bug in the ear is a very, very, very loud wasp. And it makes the victims of state violence and state exploitation subject to acting in ways that are against their best interests. Are we saying that this young man, Lisandro Guzman Feliz's entire life was about the New York City Police Department? This young man had nothing else going for himself, nothing else that he wanted to be about? Who told mom it was a good idea to bury him in that jacket? What's going on here? 6 days after your son's death, you're promoting the police department? Who's doing that dirty work? Who knocked on that mother's door and impressed upon her that that's what she must do? So it's a lot going on there, a lot going on there. But I see it will continue to unfold. And again, I believe that it will be to the detriment of the brown community in Belmont. Because just as well as we see what's going on, developers see what's going on. And the Belmont community is a hop, skip, and a jump from the Metro North Station on Fordham Road and 3rd Avenue. 3 blocks away from the Metro North Station, you can be at the Metro North. That is a dog whistle to gentrification. So Belmont will be experiencing the same state violence that Suffolk County, Long Island is experiencing with the hype around MS-13. So I encourage all black and brown youth, if you're under 30, organize for the sake of your communities. Because now the young folks are shouldering the entire community.
That was Shannon Jones of Why Accountability in New York City.
Russian President Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump will travel to Helsinki, Finland, July 16th for a summit meeting. Most people in the world think the summit is a good idea to improve relations between the two nuclear superpowers. But much of the Democratic Party in the United States is negative on the subject. Sarah Flounders is with UNAC, the United National Anti-War Coalition. In general, Flounders thinks the summit is a good thing, but she isn't optimistic about the immediate outcome.
First of all, out of the meeting will come not very much, but we saw the response of the Democratic Party to Trump's meeting with President Kim, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, and the Democrats jumped far to the right in actually attacking the meeting and calling for complete and immediate nuclear disarmament and a continuation of the war games and everything else. I mean, really an extreme position in denouncing a meeting which really came from world pressure and a refusal of many countries to any longer enforce the sanctions on Korea or the sanctions on Iran. And we should also know that there are sanctions on Russia, which the U.S. can no longer enforce because each of these countries are in new trade alliances. That doesn't mean that any meeting won't be attacked from the right and from the Democrats, who claim to be a center on many issues, but on matters of imperialist war, run neck to neck with the Democrats. So what do we expect of this meeting? I don't think very much. The U.S. is increasingly in isolation, as it is a power that is going down in its global impact because its economy is no longer the powerhouse that it was a generation ago. And the only thing it has to rely on at this stage are military threats and debt. What can they offer to countries around the world?
Yes, Trump won't even be empowered to withdraw U.S. sanctions on Russia or reduce them because of congressional action.
That's exactly right. Trump is in a position to offer much, and I think it's a good photo op, and that's of whatever value. But at the same time, every possible action is being met with greater U.S. military threats around the world. And there are real threats being made on Russia, on Iran, on China, on Syria, on Yemen. You could go country after country and look at the extensive U.S. military maneuvers that happen at the very time when the meetings are taking place. That can only be evaluated by the countries engaging in the meetings as its own threat, not as a friendly gesture.
Well, certainly the main relationship that Russia and the United States have and have had for almost 70 years is that they are the two preeminent nuclear powers facing each other.
That's certainly true. Although the U.S. has more nuclear weapons than the rest of the world put together, and that includes Russia and China and Britain and France, we should know also that the third nuclear power in terms of weapons is today supposedly Israel, who doesn't acknowledge any nuclear weapons. So exactly what the measurements are is very difficult to know in this period, but we do know that U.S. aircraft carriers, nuclear submarines, nuclear jet bombers are the real danger and threat, all taking place on 1,000 U.S. bases around the world. So Russia today is no longer the Soviet Union of 25 years ago. Russia today has an economy smaller than Brazil. It ranks about 13th in economic power, and its military power is no longer what it was. It has a base, a very small naval base in Syria, and it has a couple of posts in the former Soviet republics, which are today independent countries in Central Asia. It has some listening and exchange posts. That's the extent of what Russia has. So U.S. threats are real. They're real in terms of military, and they're real in terms of sanctions. And what they are demanding of Russia is compliance. Compliance that doesn't appear likely, at least by appearances. Compliance in Syria, in terms of Iran, and many other relations.
Russia does have bases in Syria, and so does the U.S., although the United States does not acknowledge that it has bases there. And Donald Trump has made noises about getting out of Syria, but that doesn't seem to be happening.
There doesn't appear to be any U.S. plans to really leave Syria. There's lots of talk, and yet there are lots and lots of secret military commandos, advisors, and bases now in the Kurdish region, and of course in Turkey. All of this is a constantly shifting how they count their numbers, where they count them. U.S. Intervention in Syria is huge. It's 7 years in time, and along with U.S. military in Iraq and in Turkey next door, where there's still, I believe, 14 known U.S. bases and lots of other places too.
At the G7 meeting in Canada, Trump told his partners, whom he didn't seem too friendly with, that Russia ought to be again part of G7. But Vladimir Putin doesn't seem to be interested in re-entering that configuration.
Yes, it's interesting because the day after the G7 ended, there was a very important meeting in China of the Shanghai Cooperation Summit. And this meeting, in many, many ways, far more important in terms of economic leverage of countries that before this could only look to the World Bank, the IMF, and were forced to concede to all kinds of demands coming from the major imperialist powers. G7. It is a summit of thieves and robbers, the real pirates who are looting the world. And they have photo ops, and yet what really happens behind the scenes is always their meeting about enforcing military action and sanctions on other countries. But the very fact that starting the day after in China, there was a meeting, and who attended is extremely important, Chinese President Xi, President Putin from Russia, Prime Minister Modi from India, President Hussein from Pakistan. Now, India and Pakistan, when you think about it, U.S. and British policy since the 1940s has been in how to inflame differences between India and Pakistan. So the participation of these two countries at a big summit meeting, making economic exchanges, is a new day, is a really different development. And there were also four countries from Central Asia, I believe Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, Pakistan. It's important. And what did they do at that meeting was they invited Iran's participation and membership. It was their way of responding to President Trump just unilaterally collapsing or withdrawing from the international agreement that had been signed, that had been agreed to by the UN Security Council, that Russia and China and Britain and Germany and France had all signed on to. So the U.S. withdrawal from that agreement, ordinarily, that would have been it, and a demand that the EU countries participate and any other country that wanted to do business with the U.S. And instead, the response was a number of really emerging economic powers, they invited Iran to join with them and to establish new economic relations. They've made strong statements against the sanctions on Korea, on the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. So these are the things that are changing in a big, big way. And just one meeting, one photo op can't undo that.
Yes, we can envision sometime in the near future where membership or association with the Shanghai Cooperation Organization might be seen by countries as a shield against sanctions by the United States, because there is a whole economic world in operation there, centered, of course, on China.
Very much so. Now, just to say that this summit meeting was not a revolutionary alliance by any means between India and Pakistan, Russia. These are capitalist countries, but they're not big imperialist powers such as the G7 represents. As I say, Russia's economy is smaller than Brazil. The fact that they can trade and exchange with each other and also no longer need to use the dollar. And that means that Iran also can sell its oil in exchange for Chinese yuan, which is now an international currency, and the same with Russia. So the setting up of economic exchanges and the Belt and Road Agreement, which is huge infrastructure developments of roads and ports, railroad building, pipelines, all of that is a big, big step for many of these countries that couldn't even get this from the U.S. or from Britain or France, Germany. They're not offering the economic development. What they want is the indebtedness. They want developing countries to be more helpless and interlocked to them. So this represents a big change in many, many ways and a big frustration for the U.S. and also the U.S. and the EU increasingly are fighting with each other. when Trump so rudely intervened, tweeted his conduct at the G7, it was interesting that Germany reminded the U.S. that six of the other countries have a larger economy today than the U.S. does. At the end of World War II, more than half the economic power of the world, productive capacity of the world, was in the U.S. Today, it's under 20%. So that is another development that is going on. There is a rising technological, industrial, economic development from countries that no longer need to listen to the demands of the U.S. However, U.S. military threats are very real. Sabotage, assassinations, drone attacks. It's why there's increasing lawlessness on the part of U.S. imperialism, because their other options are literally disintegrating.
Yes, one could describe the United States and Great Britain as the capitals of the financialization of things, while China is the center of the making of things.
That's certainly increasingly true. And what the implications of that will be, because the finances has got to be based on more than air and speculation, we will feel certainly in the period ahead. But we certainly feel it in the U.S. at this point, where the only thing being offered, and this is true whether you look at Supreme Court decisions of the last few days or the deindustrialization of cities, the massive cutbacks, the wages that have not gone up literally in 15 years, that the impact increasingly is the war at home, the massive, largest prison population in the world. What is that the basis of? That's the war here. And it's cutbacks in the cities in terms of housing, to mass transit, to schools. There isn't a school district in the entire country that isn't facing bankruptcy, literally, and forcing cutbacks on teachers. So the struggle has really come home, because the capitalist class is determined to have their profits, and they're ruthless in how they go about it internationally and nationally.
Well, the corporate media paints a very rosy economic picture. They say that the economy is booming, and they point to the unemployment figures, which are officially at record lows.
And those figures have been poked holes in again and again, countless studies which say the actual employment today is almost at depression era levels of employment, because who is not counted is anyone whose unemployment insurance is used up. In other words, they're considered no longer actively looking for work. Almost half the economy is connected into freelance gig economy, no benefits, no protection, no pensions, healthcare not covered. And this is especially true for young people today. There's no longer a future of solid union jobs, large productive capacity, the days of steel and auto and rubber and all of those huge plants, granaries, all of that, shipbuilding, auto, that's passe. And today, you have students with huge debt, monumental debt, and they're working as coffee baristas in jobs with absolutely no stability whatsoever. That's what the future is. And when they measure employment and unemployment, the figures are a mass of cooking books in all different ways, and not taking into account the really stable jobs that a majority of the population had in an earlier time.
Yes, perhaps we should develop a different nomenclature, a new way of describing what's out there in terms of employment, and not call it all jobs, because an employment situation in which even the number of hours is not guaranteed, and the employer has no obligations in terms of health insurance or days off or anything, well, that's not quite the same thing as what we used to call a job.
It certainly is not. And literally millions of jobs where people do not know from one week to the next whether they're working 20 hours or 60 hours. The impossibility that creates for anyone
trying to figure out daycare and trying to figure out senior care and all kinds of other responsibilities that the average person has today in an economy which is increasingly what are called precarious jobs. And they are precarious. You're literally on the edge every single week. There's no longer even an official layoff notice. It's just there aren't hours. And that means people don't even qualify for unemployment insurance that they once did. So this is how large parts of the economy are functioning. And it has a lot to do with what is happening economically here in the center of imperialism. It is maximizing of profits on every level and keeping the workforce increasingly disorganized.
And this precarity, which also includes workers who aren't in these gig jobs, but who fear they'll be plunged into them, affects the entire political environment.
It certainly does. And when we look at the Supreme Court, the Janus decision just 2 days ago, which is taking an immediate shot at the largest number of unionized workers, city, state, federal workers. If it's optional, your union dues, for many, many workers who are facing not enough, no matter where they turn, that will mean real carving into basic union protection. So there's an onslaught coming on every level. An onslaught on every level will bring resistance. But at this point, we really need to look at what's happening and that there is no plan for improving the standard of living, basic security or protection on any level whatsoever within the U.S. today, and certainly internationally, it is to increasingly use military threats and destabilization and sanctions against one country after another that suddenly finds themselves targeted. It's an onslaught. I think the scale of it is actually hard to picture for many, many people. And it doesn't need to be this way because you have the economic capacity today to literally feed and clothe and house and provide health care for the entire planet. That is the capacity, and there are countries that are determined to provide that. The U.S. economy today, the U.S. now ranks as a developing country. It's so far behind other, even industrialized countries in the standard of living.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.